Irish Illustrated Insider subscribers. This is Drew Mentak, and I'm here to bring you the 11th episode from our bi-weekly podcast series in the feed, Irish Illustrated Interviews. Today, we're sharing my conversation with Tom Carter III, a former high school quarterback who became a standout cornerback at the University of Notre Dame in the early 1990s. That is, after he learned to tackle and stopped believing Coach Lou Holtz would kick him off the team. In 1993, he was drafted to Washington in the first round of the NFL draft and spent 9 years in the league. Eventually, an injury confirmed a decision to leave the game. Still, he returned to professional football a few years later, joining the NFL Players Association as the Director of Players Affairs. He held that spot for a decade and a half. Lastly, our conversation delves into his role as CEO of the Shield Foundation, where he discusses his involvement with Project Land, which stands for Life After Notre Dame. Here's my interview with Tom. What's up, everyone? I'm here with Tom Carter III, who played defensive back at Notre Dame from 1990 to 1992, before becoming a first-round NFL draft pick and playing in the league for nearly a decade. After that, Tom, you've embarked on a very interesting career. According to your LinkedIn, at least, you've worked at a wide range of careers, such as substitute and special education teacher. You've been the director of player affairs for the NFL Players Association. Today, you're the founder and CEO of Carter Allo Consulting, the CEO of the Shield Foundation, which includes being the president of Project Land, all of which I look forward to discussing later. Tom, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start. I know you grew up in Florida in the 80s when, you know, Florida State and Miami were doing well. So I'm kind of curious how you first heard about Notre Dame and what's your first recollection of the Fighting Irish?
You know, I've always had a little bit of understanding. So some of our audience might have heard of Pat Terrell. So Pat Terrell played in Notre Dame in the late 80s. He went to my high school in St. Pete. And so at that time, when Pat went to Notre Dame, I just thought it was a school. I didn't even know where it was. And so during the high school recruitment process, of course, I was being recruited by in-state schools, Florida State, Miami. And I went down to a game, I believe it was 88, when Notre Dame came down to Miami. And that was the last time he visited down there. And something just struck me about the confidence of the men that came through that tunnel from Notre Dame. You know, it was just something different because at that time, I was a Hurricane recruit, and that's why I was going to play college ball. But then after that game, I started taking a peek at Notre Dame, and, you know, like all folks perceptually ND, I thought it was just a bunch of squares. So that game changed it all, and eventually that's the place that best fit me and my personality.
So then you go to Notre Dame, play under Lou Holtz, of course. I know you, it sounds like you played quarterback in high school and then had to transition to defensive back. Was that always the plan when you're coming to Notre Dame? And what was that process like?
That was a tough process for me. I did not play any defensive back or any receiver. The two schools I wanted to go to, as I mentioned earlier, Miami was recruiting me as a receiver. And Notre Dame was saying you would play defensive back here. So I said, okay, I appreciate the transparency that Coach Holtz displayed, obviously, and so I came in, and it was a difficult transition, playing on the defensive side of the ball, not having to experience tackling someone.
What was it like when you first got into practice? And obviously, Notre Dame was pretty good then, so you're having to go against Jerome Bettis is on the team. And
I got ran over every day. I'm like sitting here, Coach, like, I'm a buck 75. Jerome's 250. Ricky Waters 230. Tony Brooks, you know, Dorsey Levins. I'm like, we can't tackle these men. It's just impossible. And we couldn't cut in practice. So literally every day, myself and the rest of the defensive backs, we just got steamrolled. But it made us tougher. And, you know, after a while, you figured out how these grown men play football.
And was there a moment where things kind of started clicking for you? I know you played as a freshman a little bit and then really kind of started shining as your sophomore and junior. But do you have a recollection of like, oh, I kind of understand how to play defense and things like that?
You know, the competitive drive kicked in. You know, I was always, and me playing defensive back, literally, you know, basketball is my first love. You know, just being a 5'11 center in high school is not a very, you know, promising future. But I literally took all the principles I had in basketball, and they told me a defensive back, all you have to do is stay in front of the guy. I'm like, oh, I can do that. That's just basketball. And so, you know, I was blessed to do that. And, you know, Coach Holtz saw something in me, the staff, and they put me out there, deer in headlights. But it started to click after a while, you know, obviously with reps and just getting more confident. So I just thank the coaches for being very patient with me.
This is kind of getting a little ahead of things, but you played with some really good cornerbacks and defensive backs. Mm-hmm. I think you were drafted in 93 in the first round. Jeff Burris was the next year, also in the first mm-hmm. round. I think you were the mm-hmm. last two cornerbacks who went in the first round from mm-hmm. Notre Dame. So I'm kind of curious, what was it like to, and that was a different era of college football, but clearly when that like kind of last previous great era of Notre Dame football, you had such strong cornerbacks and defensive back positions. What made that kind of essential to your success back then?
It was every day, really. And I previously heard your conversation with Aaron Taylor. I'm part of that same freshman class. And so when we came in, it was literally like, all right, guys, if we can compete against each other, and that was the model back then, if we can compete against each other and practice every day, the games will be easy. And so myself, Jeff, I think Bobby Taylor came in, all those guys, and, you know, we could practice against Rocket. So we couldn't cover Rocket in practice, but just the thought of us sticking with him for like 5-10 yards gave us confidence. So that was our attitude. And we made each other better in the weight room, running sprints. So everything was competitive. And I think that's why we all, you know, want to succeed. And we all were very competitive.
And what's it like now seeing, I guess, Notre Dame kind of, you know, they played in the national championship last year after making a run through the playoffs, but such mm-hmm. a central part of the team has become the secondary. I mean, they're starting to get kind of first, second round caliber cornerbacks again. They led the mm-hmm. nation in pass efficiency defense for the last 2 years. What's it like to see that being so pivotal to the success once again?
That's great. You know, all those cornerbacks, we had a little different mentality. You know, we all think we're the, you know, greatest thing since sliced bread. And I love to see the confidence of this secondary. I believe they have that same. You know, if you are playing that position and you don't have that confidence, then that's not the spot for you. So when I look at our secondary now, I see kids who believe they are the best in the country. And some probably aren't the best in the country. So that's a great attitude that I love to see.
And what are some highlights from your time at Notre Dame, whether that's like a game or two that really stand out? I know you had, I believe, 10 or so interceptions in your career. Is there a pick that really sticks out to you? What are some highlights that you really remember fondly?
The most valuable lesson, the biggest highlight I still harp on, is my freshman year, starting against the University of Miami, big game, right? And I'm playing safety, and this pass comes over the middle, and I'm like, I'm going to get my first pick against Miami, and I'm going up. I stood in my spot, and all of a sudden, out of my corner, Todd Light comes by, snatches the ball out of the air. And I'm like, so that taught me a valuable lesson. I never waited for another interception for the rest of my career. So, yes. And literally, and that's how obviously when I teach younger kids, I'm like, you know, the ball is not meant to come to you, so you need to go attack it. And so, yeah, that's probably my biggest memory from my days at Notre Dame.
Oh, that's really interesting. So not necessarily something that worked out for you, but something that you really draw mm-hmm. lessons from.
Yes, absolutely. Still one of those things. I was reading the print all before the ball got to my hand, like, oh, it's going to be a great play. And, you know, not so, happening.
So you played for 3 years at Notre Dame, and then you decided to enter the NFL draft. I'm kind of curious, going from a guy who you came in, you had never even played defense really before, at least not even in high school. We're getting used to tackling, to kind of developing to the point where then you could make that jump to the NFL so quickly. What was that process like, and what kind of led you to making that decision and betting on yourself kind of early in your development at corner?
Yeah, it was just confidence. The same way that the kids today that you see, obviously, you know, from Ben Morrison, you see more of these kids. And so when I saw Todd got picked 5th in the draft. So I knew what the standard was. And so obviously my freshman year, I was nowhere near that. So by the time my sophomore year, I believe Rod Smith, who was the opposite corner of me my sophomore year, he got drafted 2nd round. So for 2 years in a row, I saw what the best in the country would look like. And then I just continued to develop off the field. And then by the time my 3rd year came around, I felt comfortable, you know, making a leap to do that. I guess me and Jerome decided to leave school our junior year, which was not, you know, looked upon back in those days. So it was a big decision.
And so but it worked out. I mean, you're the 17th overall pick by the then Washington Redskins, and went in and, you know, you started 11 games. I think you had 6 interceptions. You finished 2nd in the AP's Defensive Rookie of the Year Award. What was it like again, adjusting to that next level and finding early success. Again, that's your fourth year playing cornerback, and you're doing all that.
You know, and obviously I go to a team, and still today, you know, Darryl Green, I consider one of my mentors. It's very humbling, right? The Todd Light situation, coming to Washington as a first-round kid, you know, and I go to a team to where, all right, now you're going against a guy who's opposite, who runs a 4-1. It's like, it just blew my mind away. I'm like, I'm the slow corner now. I'm like, everybody's picking on me. They're throwing the ball over here. So that was trial by fire. But I just thank God for the men on that team, the men of faith. You know, I had Darryl Green, Art Monk, you know, Charles Mann, a lot of older veterans who really taught me how to be a pro. And so throughout my career, I wanted to do the same for young guys. So I was just very fortunate. Notre Dame and Washington coming to those two teams.
That's an interesting point, too. I think a lot of times you see statistics with defensive back or cornerback, and sometimes mm-hmm. that's actually a direct result of teams wanting to throw at you, and you kind of have to prove yourself. So it's almost the guys who don't have those interceptions or pass breaks ups. It's sometimes means they're the more experienced or prominent player.
I was not delusional. And once again, a valuable lesson Darryl Green taught me. He said, hey, son, if you come out the game with no dirt on your uniform, that means you had a perfect game. So no one threw at you. You had no tackles. And so at the end of that season, I had the dirtiest uniform on the team. I got tried every week. So, you know, stats can be misleading, but, you know, that's just how that position works.
And how do you feel like you spent 4 years in Washington? The next 3 years, the seasons there, you were a full-time starter. What do you feel like kind of put you in that position? And you know, you still had 12 interceptions over those next three seasons, so we're still making plays. What do you think kind of elevated your game after you kind of got that rookie year out of the way?
Just the confidence in the reps. Obviously, you know, I got married that same year, 93, to my high school sweetheart, you know, still married today, going over 32 years. Congrats. So that, and just building and learning. The game's tough. You know, the physical part, for most athletes, that's like, I don't want to say easy, but it is. Once you get to that talent level, it's more mental. Right? How are you going to handle the stresses off the field? You know, how are you going to handle family? How are you going to handle friends? How are you going to handle seeing your name on SportsCenter as, you know, is this guy a flop? So those type of things, that is the weight. And if you learn how to navigate that stuff, and at an early age, I stopped reading the newspaper clippings. And so that was from my veteran leadership. They was like, hey, if you're not going to read if you want to read the good, you got to read the bad. So pick a lane. And I say, well, I'm not going to read either one.
is there like a SportsCenter low light or a newspaper clipping or anything that kind of stands out that really drilled home that message for you?
It was obviously, you know, I think the day after I got drafted, you know, I said this at I spoke earlier at a different event, you know, the headline of the paper says St. Petersburg newest millionaire. And I'm like, whoa, that's supposed to be a private matter. Like, you know, this is close. Like, the people look at you differently than, you know, so that kind of stung a little bit. Then I got to Washington, you see the headlines, you know, did we draft the right kid? Is he going to be a bust? So obviously things that are natural in the sports world, you know, for journalists to write, you know, all athletes, I shouldn't say all, the majority of us, we bruise like peaches. We have real, we are real sensitive, and I am no different. So that was just something that I learned early on, just to focus on the work.
And then after 4 seasons in Washington, you played for the Chicago Bears. What kind of led to that transition, and what was your time like in Chicago?
Yeah, I was a free agent at the time, and obviously me and Darryl were up at the same year. And so obviously it's a 10-time 12 pro, you know, Pro Bowl, like, you know, which one are you going to pay? And so obviously it was a business decision. Obviously Chicago was great for me, life-changing for our family. I had a great time there. So that was the primary factor for leaving, but I definitely wanted to stay in Washington.
And then you finished up your career in Cincinnati. What was it like kind of being at the back end of your career? I assume your role starts to change a little bit, and what's it like adapting to that?
I did, you know, at that time I think we had our fourth kid, so life was totally different, right? You know, you see things. I think my last season of the preseason, I came out of a halftime, and for the first time, I saw a lineman was 6'6", 320. I never saw that before. I'm like, this guy's huge, and I got to go hit him? So, you know, that's why I say the game's all mental. And when I, and when that clicked in, I'm like, oh, it might be time. And literally a couple weeks later, literally the week after 9/11, I played my last football game. I tore a knee ligament.
Oh man, it's kind of a tough way to have that decision made for you almost.
It did make it for him, but like I say, 2-3 weeks before that in the preseason, I had never had that feeling before. And so I'm like, okay, and now I'm seeing things that men probably should be running each other at full speed. At, you know, a 300-pound guy should not hit a 180-pound guy. That's not fair.
And what was that transition like? You mentioned Aaron Taylor earlier. I know he that's something he struggled with, transitioning from football to life after. I know you got into substitute teaching, it sounds like, immediately, and then became a special education teacher and football coach. What was it like kind of trying to find that path and how you wanted to find maybe that purpose?
That's difficult. It's one of the, it is a difficult thing. And obviously, when athletes speak it, most people don't want to hear it. It's like, oh, you guys got first world problems. Like, you just made a couple million bucks. You know, you got money. I sat on the couch for about 4 months. Like, oh, I'm retired. We got money. We got this. And I just, my wife, she's like, what do you do? I'm like, I'm watching Ambush Makeover and Oprah. Like, what am I supposed to do? I'm retired. And so she basically like say, get off the couch, dude. And so that's when I started substitute teaching. And I didn't know, you know, how much, you know, I needed to be out and be a part of society. So I've always loved teaching. That was a passion for me. So when I did that, I just one job led to another job. But yeah, having that first step in the transition is very difficult.
Curious what that was like. You worked at Dominion High School in Sterling, Virginia, so not, I guess I'm not positive where that is, but I assume it's not terribly far from DC. What was it like working with kids? And I mean, they had a recent NFL player instructing them.
I love it. I still to this day, I've always said, I'm going to go back and be a teacher. You know, teaching's in my blood. I was working in the ministry at the time. I was put on a football clinic and I needed to go to the high school to secure a field. And so when I went to the principal, get all the stuff straightened out, and I just came to me and said, obviously, you know, do you want to teach? I'm like, I said, I love teaching. He said, well, you know, we love to have African-American teachers for our students. We're short. And I just thought that was another call of a different form of ministry. And I just jumped on it and loved it every day. So, yeah, but it also taught me a lesson. I hate to say a call. I call non-pro athlete civilians. All right. So when I'm sitting in the cafeteria and I'm hearing, you know, how, you know, people feel about pro athletes, it was like really eye-opening. It was like, oh, you know, and most, you know, sometimes they didn't know I was around and hopefully I was part of the staff, but I could hear how they speak about athletes. Oh, he's just spoiled. Oh, he doesn't do this. I'm like, I just sat there like, all right, you know, these guys are human too. They just happen to be, you know, 6'5" with 3% body fat, but they're still human.
That's really interesting thinking like you're hearing those like kind of near around the water cooler conversations that, I mean, I'm sure we all have, but I'm sure that hits a little differently. And maybe, as you mentioned, at being 180 pounds, you kind of were less assuming than a 6'5" guy would have been too.
Oh,
so maybe
And obviously, you know, I love everybody, you know, and I just wanted to make them more aware. Obviously we all had kids, and I'm always, when I see parents who have kids who are 19 to 22, I actually expect more from them. I'm like saying, you're a 22-year-old. You don't put them to the same level as you hold this kid in college. They're the same maturity. Maybe your kid might be more mature and still making the same mistakes. So obviously, if people make it more personal, I know these kids out there have super athletic abilities, but you know, they're still the same age as your kids and still making the same mistakes mentally that your kids make. So when I had a moment, I would share, but I do understand we are entertainment and people want to have a place to vent.
No, I think that's a good perspective. And from there, you went from teaching to the director of player affairs for the NFL Players Association. Curious how you that role came up and how you made that transition from being a special ed teacher to getting back into that profession.
I've been very blessed. Literally every job I've had, I absolutely loved and wanted to do it. So at that time, and I guess toward the end of 2006, Gene Upshaw, who was the head of the Players Association, you know, he asked me to come on staff. And during my playing days, I was a player rep. So I was familiar with the role. And I said, Gene, I can't take this job. You know, it requires me to travel 35, 40 weeks a year. You know, I got four little kids. My wife would never. And sure enough, I went home and I told the wife, but the opportunity is like, take the job. I'm like, so obviously it was a major sacrifice, you know, on her part, me being away for that long, but it was my calling, you know, just being in the locker room. I'm a protector. And so with these young men helping them out, you know, dealing with their agents, dealing with off the field things, dealing with obviously the relationship with ownership and coaches and management and collectively bargaining, the CBA, all those things, just, it was like 10,000 jobs in one. So every day my job looked different.
I'm definitely curious to hear a little more about that. Like, were you reviewing contracts to make sure they're in compliance with the CBA or with what the agents are allowed to take, or what was kind of that role like?
I said my primary role was compliance. And so after we do the CBA, all the rules are in the book. And so if anybody violates the rule, it's my job to come in and enforce it. And so if they have a disagreement with their agents, then I would step in and say, all right, well, this is how it needs to be settled. All right, if you have a disagreement with the club, i.e., you know, we had one of our players who was 1 pound overweight and he got fined, I don't know, I can't think of the fine, maybe $15,000-$20,000 for being 1 pound overweight. And so these are the things that you have to, you know, you go through this whole little grievance about, okay, did you wear them in the morning, afternoon? What's the deal? You know, so
yeah,
you know, I can get as minute to that. So obviously some of our very serious issues, so when guys off the field, and obviously worst case scenario, when one of our players lose their lives, we got to come in and step in the benefits.
Okay.
So it ranges it for a little bit of everything.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Cause I mean, your weight can vary by 4 or 5 pounds just depending on the day. So it's, I didn't realize that what type of thing was even in an NFL contract.
Oh yeah. It's in there. You gotta, you know, make sure everybody, you know, some of our big guys might get a couple extra Big Macs during the week. You never know how that turns out.
And so you mentioned you're traveling a lot. Were you just visiting every team and kind of going through things? Like, what was that? What did the travel entail?
Yeah, you have to visit. We got 32 NFL teams. At that time, I first got there, I was responsible for 11 NFL teams. And so you visit them 4 or 5, 6 times a year. I believe we had arena football. We had bought them underneath our tent at the Union.
Oh, wow.
So, but we were helping those athletes set up. And then I just had the Pro Bowl, Super Bowl, you know, playoffs, teams all. So anywhere the players are, obviously they wanted to have representation from the union. So yeah, that was my life for almost 15 years.
And you mentioned collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious, when the CBA is coming up or is about to come up and you're starting to negotiate, mm-hmm. what's that process like? Are you preparing years in advance? Are you getting the players input on what things you need to lobby for? How are you
Absolutely.
Go about that?
Yeah. And obviously, yes, all of the above, you know, and I love our locker room. And obviously it's just a microcosm of our country. So I look at everybody, we got 2,000 players in the NFL. That's it. That's the population. Those are the guys who get a vote. And those guys come from different backgrounds, from Highland Park to South Central LA, right? So you got guys who are first round guys. You got guys who are free agent picks, and everyone has a different thing they want. And so trying to put everyone's ideals on one thought and getting everything is very tough to do. And so obviously you have to keep unity. You got to talk about things that in totality that makes us better instead of what's making you better. Like, you know, and so that's one valuable lesson I learned from Gene Upshaw. He's basically told all the players, like, you know, don't bring selfish ideas that only benefits you. Bring ideas that benefits the whole. So we got to educate our players just not to bring an ideal that's going to make their salary better.
And you did that job for 14 and a half years or so. Are, is there any like moments or examples that really stick out to you about maybe a way you had an impact, even if it's on a specific player or yeah, if there's any really fond memories from that time?
Yeah, I think one of our biggest things we did was, you know, get rid of 2 days. You know, that was one of the, in 2010, I was like, hey, and guys were saying, hey, our bodies are getting beat up. This is a physical sport, you know. And football, you know, it can look different from one team to the next. You know, when I played, you know, I played for, you know, the old Washington Redskins Commanders now. And that was a pound every day. as opposed to my high school teammate, William Floyd. He went to San Francisco and they wore caps to practice every day. All right. So you can't say pounding every day produces win because it doesn't, because San Francisco didn't hit at all. You know, Jeff Burris played at Buffalo. Jeff, same thing, they didn't hit. So it was somewhere in like, all right, guys, how can we be better coaches? So I think that kind of changed all the sports. You got to be a better coach now. Instead of going out there just pounding guys into the ground, you need to know how to educate and teach them and keep conditioned.
Was that a difficult process to get the teams or especially the coaches to relinquish that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you can't change nothing. Like, this is work. You know, this is Lombardi. This is how it works. You got to do. And truth, it is a physical sport. And you cannot take physicality out of that. But, you know, as you get to that level, you know, by the time you make it to the league, you are physical. It's just about now, how do you hone it in? Because obviously you got data from San Fran and Buffalo going to Super Bowls every year. And obviously, you know, the Dallas format was like, hey, Dallas pounds every day. You know, if you guys all saw the special on the Cowboys, like, hey, there's a lot of ways to do it, but what's the most healthy way for the total athletes to be better?
Then in the middle of 2021, you left that role and founded Carter Allo Consulting. I'm kind of curious what led to your decision to step away and why did you decide you wanted to work for yourself in some capacity?
Yeah, it was more of a challenge. Obviously, my wife is going to be a continual theme, right? We've been together since high school. And, you know, I was going back to school. I got my master's and then, you know, I went back and got the doctor. She's like, all right, buddy, you know, what are you going to do now, smart guy? I'm like, hey, I'm good. She's like, so that was more of a challenge. And that was literally at the beginning of this whole NIL thing. And it was just, it still hurts my soul today to see adults talking to 16-year-old kids about sports in high school and protecting. So that always rubbed me because now you have this agent rep talking to a kid, our family in high school that doesn't know anything about the sport, even college. I know our professionals didn't know. So at the start of this thing, there was no representation and I didn't want to charge percentages. I didn't want to rip kids off. Right. So it was just more like, how can I consult to help parents and kids make the best decision in sports? And so that's how Carter Allo came up. And so I still today continue to help kids and parents navigate through the space because not all the actors in this space are good.
Definitely. And I'm curious at some of the challenges of that. Obviously, covering Nordy and myself, I mean, I've seen even just over the last 4 years, how different NIL has changed in the rules surrounding it and even the NCAA's ability to enforce certain things. What's it like to have to kind of keep up with all that so that you can advise the young athletes properly?
Yeah, my thing is just transparency. And so, you know, I know the power of agents, right? I knew how valuable my agent was to me. And I know the role they play in sports, especially in our professional sports. They are, you know, the go-between. And I see right now it's unregulated, which makes it not good because now, you know, the professional sports at the union, all the agents had to come through us and then we can discipline them. Now it's just Uncle Joe can be an agent, you know, Cousin Vinny. So you don't know what's going on and there's no consequences if this agent does, you know, bad things to the players.
And forgive me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that that you also with the NFL dictated the cut that the agents could take. Absolutely. Whereas now, yeah. Even, I mean, I think I've seen, you know, 20 plus percentages coming out for college football players. So is that to the type of thing you're
absolutely
trying to educate them on?
That's why I educate the parents. I try to say, well, what in the world, you know, and this language we're using right now is how the agents, which is, are getting away with this because as long as you call a duck, a pig, you call it a marketing deal, they can take 20% of marketing. But we all know what it is. It's not a marketing deal. It's a, you know, performance. And so these agents are charging 20%, which is like, you know, it blows my brain when at the NFL level, we have mandated now to some places down to 1.5%.
Oh, wow.
So now you see the contrast between 1.5, 3% all the way up to 20. So 3 is the max. 1.5 is the minimum in the professional sports. And I am, so if agents hear this, I am not talking bad. Once again, they saved me. I needed them. They are needed in the industry, Right. And the good ones know that. It's just that for those individuals who are taking some of these kids' finances, who might, this might be the last chance to earn this type of money, it's pretty tough.
One more question on this. With the revenue sharing aspect that's now allowed in college sports, is that different in terms of the cut an agent can take, since that's not marketing or through NIL? Or I'm kind of curious if that changes what they can do there.
It's still considered marketing.
Okay.
Because the revenue share is not for performance. It's for marketing. So the schools are taking a revenue share to pay for the kid's likeness.
Okay.
So once again, so if you're calling it a duck, that's what it's going to be, marketing.
Okay. That's really, really interesting that they can still get around that.
Yeah, they can. And not all do. So please don't.
Right.
Not all do. I think some of the larger agencies, they understand that and they want to create long-term relationships. So that is great. And they don't take anything from the kids. So that's what you want, for them to treat it as a marketing deal. So that is my goal. If we are calling it a marketing deal, but the agents really know what it is, that they can, you know, help these young men and women out and be transparent with them.
And then, addition to that, you also in 2022 became the CEO of the Shield Foundation. So you're providing current and former student athletes with the resources necessary to ensure a successful transition in life after sports. So it kind of sounds like you're dealing with kind of the opposite end of the spectrum with your consulting business, where you're looking at what they do after they've gotten to college and potentially the professional level. What's that role been like, and what's it like to kind of be part of that whole process almost for athletes?
This is where rubber hits the road. This is like, you know, for all, not just football. And that's what I love about our university, Notre Dame. You know, we're the first college to actually tangibly do something to help these young men and women transition. And we kept it really simple. You know, me being a little scientist, you know, you as a reporter, you know, 98% of the people who play college sports would not be pros, right? And if we, you know, use the geek science term, statistically significant, but not, that's a fact. So in the science world, if something is 98%, it's considered a fact. But we spend all weekend watching non-facts, right? And right. So we think it's a norm. And so I'm glad universities are addressing the fact that these kids coming to schools will not be pros and they need help transitioning, right? Because when I was in school, I promise you, I did not know what a career center was. All right. I know I could not go to career day because I had practice. I'm spending 6 to 8 hours at the football facility. And so our athletes, you know, it's a lot of pride. And obviously, I heard some of the interviews you did. You all going to go through a little transition of difficulty when you leave. So we're just there to help them out with their resumes, help them put together LinkedIn's if they are having some physical ailments. Dr. Reitigan, who's my former teammate at Notre Dame, you know, for all indie athletes, can come back and get some orthopedic care. And obviously on the mental health side, if our athletes need to speak with someone, we can connect them. So I think it's a model that all schools should do, because we invest so much into them when they're there. But when the music stops, you know, who's going to be there for them?
And kind of more specifically, you mentioned Notre Dame. So the specific project is Project LAND, and that stands for Life After Notre Dame. How did that idea come about, and when did that kind of officially get implemented, and what's it been like so far?
Yeah, my partner, Jack Shields, obviously we can have a whole segment on Jack, and along with Pat Eilers. Pat and I were former teammates in Washington. We were talking about how can we help our athletes. And unfortunately, Drew, as you know, or might not know, we've lost about 10 to 12 athletes through death by suicide of Notre Dame football players in the last 10 years.
I didn't know that, actually.
So, you know, it's quiet, but it's like, you know, our goal is how do we help these young men and women who've done so much for the school at their most vulnerable point? And I think Jack Schwarbrick, you know, for taking the meeting with me and Jack Shield at the time. So, you know, I think this is one of the things he did at the end of his legacy that's going to carry on forever, right? And so he had a heart for that. And so when we came in, we said, all right, well, how can we help our athletes who are not doing well mentally transitioning? And that's basically how we started. It was just simple. And then from there, we added on just to the physical health, right? We want to take care of, because we always promised this whole, at my time, it was 4 for 40, right?
Right.
That's the recruiting pitch, right? And so, yep. we wanted to be the tangible piece of that. Now is for forever, which is more accurate. Like, we will take care of you in this aspect, whether it's mental, physically, or try to help you with a career job. So from there, just built until we are now today. We know we almost placed 100 athletes with jobs.
Wow.
Academy has mental help and physical help. And so we are doing what the school is called to do.
And how important is that process? I mean, you mentioned your wife was there to kind of be like, hey, you need to get off the couch. But I'm guessing it's not necessarily as easy for people to kind of start finding something else to do. How important is that for their mental health to kind of help guide them through that transition?
It's everything. You know, I've had a son who went to Stanford and played professionally. And it's tough, right? Even inside, right? We preach it every day. And so if kids don't come from a background to where they have two parents there, or they have a wife there, someone saying, hey, you need to do this. And that's why I'm always leaning on my peers who have kids that same age, because the civilian kids are still going through the transition when they come back home. All right. They're trying to find a job. You know how difficult the job market is. And so our kids who play sports, they're coming from, all right, I lost the thing I've been identified myself as, which they probably shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And now I have to find a job. I'm embarrassed to go back in. Everybody can look at me like, oh, I thought you were a superstar. Like, what are you doing coming to here working? You should be good. Like, no. So these are things that we need to coach our athletes up and say, it's just coaching. You can do it. You need to get out there. You need to put your hands to the plow and figure out how to, create something for yourself.
And Tim Priester wrote a feature on you. I believe it was last year. And I think one of the mm-hmm. things he noted in that is that you also help out with the fantasy camps at mm-hmm. Notre Dame, which I've never actually watched, but my understanding is that is like where adults can come back and be on the field and go through drills. What's that like to be involved with that and see some people, I guess, living out a dream that you got to live out years ago?
Man, those guys have so much courage. I'm like, there's no way. My hamstrings just hurt watching those guys move. But you see the passion they have, right? And I don't know when this is going to air, but I just saw a piece yesterday with Coach Freeman on the Today Show. And he gave a little speech to the crew. And so when I see those fantasy guys, how much they love being on that field, it took me back to that moment, like how I felt my first start, right? So if you can, when I go to that fantasy camp and I see their eyes light up, when I see them come down that tunnel, like, all right, this is their moment. And so that, it puts into perspective how special that school is, because I've been all around the country, I've been to a lot of colleges. Ain't nobody having fantasy camps at their school to everybody feeling this nostalgic, passion for the school. So yeah, it's pretty special.
Really cool. And you just touched on Marcus Freeman. I know you've definitely got to interact with him, especially mm-hmm. in your role. What's it been like to get to know him and see even how he's grown as a head coach over these last four seasons?
No, he's a rock star. Just the fact he communicates with the kids. We call it talking uptown and downtown, right? I can talk to you any kind of way just to get my message across to you. And I think that resonates with the athletes, the transparency, the challenging. I think Marcus is the ultimate definition of how coaches can still be as rigid and firm without being the old school. So you can do it. It's right. Just you better have Marcus Freeman gifts.
Yeah, I guess not everybody has those.
Not everybody has a gift like that, no.
And you mentioned Jack Swarbrick bringing you on to help with Project mm-hmm. Land. How much has the university embraced that side or using that and with that for forever message? Is that something you're brought in with recruiting messages or for those weekends or anything like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're using all the above. Last year, and obviously Pete Bavak, when he came in, Pete came in bear hugging land. But under Pete's leadership, we've taken off. We have a partnership with the school now. We meet with them weekly. We talk about athletes. We are, to your point, used in the recruiting weekends. I came a couple weekends last year. And so that is what Notre Dame's about. Our kids are not, the kids that you see coming to school right now, they know and their parents know this is just a four-year thing. And the parents are saying, it's a fact, son, you won't play pro ball. Even if you play pro ball, you're going to be done in 2-3 years. And so that is the whole thing. That's what Notre Dame sells, because we're saying, what are you going to do when you're done playing? And so that's what LAN encapsulated for all the sports at Notre Dame. And hopefully we can continue to help these young men and women out at their most vulnerable spots.
And even just as a former player and an alumni, what's it like for you to see Notre Dame kind of walking the walk after they, you know, they've had the 4 for 40, you mentioned 4 for forever now, like they're doing some of those extra steps to make sure they're actually implementing that. And it's not just a clever slogan.
We love it. That means we're going to drink the Kool-Aid again. So if I see it on the count, I'm going to drink it again. So, and, you know, so I think that's what we all believe when we signed up for it. That's what we thought. And so when you actually see it, that's all you can ask for. That's all a parent can ask when you send your child to the school, is that they're thinking about when the real world starts. You know, no parents send their kid to Notre Dame are thinking about, oh, my kid can play pro. They want them to, but we all know, you know, you got to come out into the civilian world. And so I think that's what we're doing, preparing these young men and women to be productive, you know, civilians.
And I believe it's not just for the players. It could be for other students who are associated with the program in some way too.
Yeah, trainers, because they're spending the same 8 hours a week. You know, student managers spending more time. Like, thought we had to bad those managers there. I don't know how they find time to study. And so we wanted to encompass everyone who has a part in athletics, right? And so we know how much time it is, and they really appreciate the fact, because we do miss a lot of stuff on campus. So we just, I know some people feel different about it, thinking the athletes already got too much already. But, you know, our world is that those resources just don't, might not be a teachable moment to teach me about a career day in the middle of sophomore year when, you know, SC's coming up.
Yeah. And lastly, I definitely want to get some thoughts on Leonard Moore, just to kind of wrap up. I mean, obviously, we've seen a lot of what he's doing on the field. He's a finalist for the Thorpe Award right now. This should come out on next Friday, which I believe is the 12th of December. So I'm not sure when those decisions are made. But I'm kind of curious on what you saw from him last year in his development and where you've seen kind of his game take off this year.
You know, Leonard is amazing. Obviously, with Ben Morrison, me and Ben Dad's played together, so I watched Ben grow up from a baby, you know, more of a godparent to Ben. And so I remember the first day when the freshman came in, I said, Ben, any kids out there? He's like, this kid, Leonard Moore, he's real. Like, I said, I didn't hear much about him. And so from that point, I've been watching him. What Leonard has is a no fear. It's a confidence. He's so physical and strong, and it's effortless. So when I'm watching him play ball, you know, you could even see it on the tackles he makes. It's like he's hitting like a safety, right? And, you know, guys come down, he's covering, his ball skills are off the chart, right? His hand placement in the line of scrimmage. When you watch a corner of the line of scrimmage and you don't see a guy fast, you know, retreating, it's like, oh, he's not scared. So we always said cornerbacks, you know, we call it your back leg shaking. I mean, you're trying to run out because you're scared you're going to get ran by. You see none of that with Leonard. So with his size, his athleticism, his strength, he's definitely one of the top guys in America.
To your point, I remember Leonard Moore enrolled last summer, so he wasn't an early enrollee. And Morrison, when we talked to him in August, the media, he mentioned that, I think he went as far as to say, Leonard Moore will be better than me, which is quite the statement to make about a kid who wasn't even rated quite that highly. And then, I mean, we saw that he lived up to that fairly quickly.
Ben's dad is a tough guy to, you know, to give compliments. And so, you know, we were talking about practice, and I talked to Daryl, Ben's dad, a lot. He's like, this 15 kid is real. So for Ben's dad to say that about another kid, I'm like, oh, he can play.
Awesome. Well, it's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for being here with me today and kind of walking me through your journey and all the different things you're up to now to still kind of be assisting and helping the program today.
Thank you for your time.
So I'm in everybody listening. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back again in 2 weeks with another episode.